From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The presidential campaign, counting the primaries, is costing about $400 million. Where's the money coming from? On today's Fresh Air, we find out. We'll talk to Robert Krulwich about his new documentary, The Best Campaign Money Can Buy. It investigates the largest campaign donors and the interests they represent. The program airs tonight on the public TV series Frontline. Also, we talk with painter Larry Rivers about painting nude portraits of his mother-in-law and his son. Rivers has written a new memoir. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new CD single of Mahler's Adagietto from his Fifth Symphony. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The U.S. economy grew at a brisk pace in July, August, and September, expanding at an annual rate of 2.7%, according to a report from the Commerce Department. NPR's John Idstey reports.
The economy's performance in the third quarter surpassed most economists' expectations and nearly doubled the rate of growth in April, May, and June. The stronger growth came mostly because of a revival in consumer spending. It grew by $27 billion in the summer quarter. But economists noted that incomes grew more slowly than consumer spending, suggesting consumers will have to cut back in the future, which would slow growth. This and several other details of the report led a number of economists to the conclusion that the stronger-than-expected growth is unlikely to continue. Today's report is the first measure of third-quarter growth and is subject to revision in the coming weeks. The positive numbers did give President Bush, who's presided over the slowest growth in several decades, a chance to argue the economy is doing better. I'm John Idstey in Washington.
The third quarter economic growth apparently wasn't strong enough to be perceived by most consumers. The Conference Board reported today that its index of consumer confidence fell to its lowest level in 8 months in October. The report said that people in one in three of the households surveyed said they'd been significantly affected by the recession. The survey is based on 5,000 households. One in four said that someone in the household had been unemployed in the past year. Of those who found new jobs, well over half took positions that paid less money. Democratic presidential candidate Bill Clinton is campaigning through the South today with stops in Georgia, Florida, Texas, and Louisiana. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
In the South, Clinton has been aiming his message at more conservative swing voters, stressing his support for voluntary prayer in schools, and telling voters that government should encourage adoption as an alternative to abortion. In Augusta, Georgia, this morning, he claimed he was leading a new Democratic Party that could reach out to a broad base of voters.
That Republicans and independents and former Perot supporters have rallied to the cause of the Clinton-Gore ticket because they think we represent the only hope for real change.
A new CNN poll shows that Clinton's pitch is working in the South. According to the poll, he now has the support of 33% of Southern whites, to Bush's 39%. Republicans have won the South in the past because they have received 60 to 70% of the white vote, enough to offset a solid Democratic black vote in the South. But now Clinton is splitting half the white vote with Perot, threatening the key to the Republican lock on the region. In Tampa, Florida, I'm Mara Liasson.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 8 points to close at 3,235.7. Declines edged advances in heavy trading of about 202 million shares. This is NPR. Israel, Lebanon, and Syria said today that they'll continue peace talks despite the continuing violence in southern Lebanon. The fighting started Sunday when guerrillas from the Iranian-backed Hezbollah faction ambushed an Israeli patrol in South Lebanon and killed 5 soldiers. Israel responded with heavy air, sea, and artillery attacks on villages it says are guerrilla bases. Lebanon's chief negotiator said today that the Israeli military response was out of proportion to the provocation, but that his country is determined to pursue peace negotiations. Today, the Federal Centers for Disease Control proposed to expand the definition of AIDS to include conditions found primarily among women and intravenous drug users. Activists say the expanded definition would give more people access to AIDS benefits. NPR's Richard Harris has the story.
the CDC proposed expanding the definition of AIDS more than a year ago to include all HIV-infected people with severely damaged immune systems. But that proposal didn't satisfy AIDS activists, who wanted the definition to include some diseases that are found primarily among women and IV drug users. Today, the CDC finally proposed adding three of those conditions to the formal definition of AIDS: cervical cancer, tuberculosis of the lungs, and recurrent pneumonia. The new definition will take effect January 1st of next year. The CDC estimates that it will increase the number of AIDS cases from 50,000 a year to 80,000 or more. AIDS activists hope that the broadened definition will give more people access to health care through private insurance and local agencies, but the new definition won't change who's eligible for federal disability and Medicare benefits. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
A French doctor who was convicted for his role in a contaminated blood scandal was expelled today from the French Medical Society. Michel Garetta was convicted of allowing the distribution of blood that officials knew was contaminated with the virus associated with AIDS. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As Ross Perot can tell you, running for president of the United States isn't cheap. As you know, big money often comes with big strings attached. In the 70s, campaign finance reforms were enacted to limit special interest funding of candidates. But big loopholes have opened up that system to what has been described as legal graft. Donors are prohibited from giving more than $1,000 to an individual candidate, but there are no such limitations on the amount that can be given to a political party. Money given to the party is called soft money, and it's supposed to be used for indirect activities like generic party advertisements and get-out-the-vote drives. But the money is often used to fund specific campaigns and sometimes seems to influence the candidate's policies. Robert Krulwich investigates this in the new Frontline documentary called The Best Campaign Money Can Buy. You can see it tonight on public television. Krulwich is a CBS economic correspondent. He used to be the economics reporter for NPR. He found the Republicans and the Democrats have clubs for large donors. Democrats who give at least $200,000 can join the managing trustees.
It's a high entry fee. You have to give the Democratic Party, not Bill Clinton, but the Democratic Party, $200,000 of your own money or more. If you do that, you get this managing trustee moniker. And that entitles you to sort of silly privileges. You can go to the national conventions and sit in the Sky booth. You can have briefings from members of the campaign. And you get to meet all the other managing trustees, which, at least on the Republican side, turned out to be a big deal. And you also, presumably, will have your calls returned later on when your candidate is elected, if he is.
So for the Democrats, they have the managing trustees at $200,000 per person. The Republicans have Team 100. What do they have to pay to get in?
Well, now here's a switch. You'd think the Republicans would charge $350 if the Democrats were charging $2, but the Republicans, you can get into their Team 100 group at $100,000. And so for $100,000 to the Republican Party, you become a Team 100 member. The Team 100 organization has been around for a longer time. And they are a fascinating group of people. They are all mostly self-made, very rich people, as are the Democrats. They're a little older than the Democratic group. And they do things together, in season and out of season. They take trips together to Eastern Europe. They go to Russia. They get briefings at the White House with during the non-political years. And they have joint events. I got the impression over time that for the Republicans on the Team 100 group, being in the group was a kind of networking, Jerry Rubin-style club in which politics was a reason to get together, but hardly the main reason. It seemed to be just a gathering of big businessmen who do business with each other.
Well, if I paid my $100,000 or $200,000 to be in this Democratic or Republican club, what would I get in return besides the perks? I mean, how much access would I get to my candidate?
That is hard to say specifically. It's quite clear that if you're in that group, when you call the White House or when you want to visit a senior member of the administration on the Republican side, because as you may recall, we only had Republican presidents recently, you do get the appointment. Beyond that, on the Democratic side, I suppose it's the anticipation of making the calls and getting the access is driving some of them. Beyond that, though, I think there's a sort of trophy president feeling. You know, this man is your president. A lot of these guys have pictures, you know, of themselves with the candidates and of themselves beautifully and very personally autographed by the candidate. And they have a very strong personal loyalty, it seems. But in our documentary, we take it the next step. One of them, Howard Leach, who's a member of the Team 100 group, he gets into an automobile in the springtime with President Bush, and they go for a ride to a rally that Howard Leach is sponsoring for George Bush as a candidate. And they're talking. Howard Leach describes the conversation. He says, "Mr. President, you know what we really need in the valley in California is we need more water for the businessmen down here. Water, as we all know, falls from heaven in the northern part of California and then flows through various viaducts and so on to the southern part of California. The federal government subsidizes and controls the movement of water in much of California, and it is within the power of the president to move great gobs of water from the north to the south. Howard Leach wanted the water moved from the north to the south, and 9 days after that ride in the car, President Bush, by his own order, moved hundreds of millions of gallons of water from the north to the south part of California. As a result, and you'll see this in the documentary, farmers and fishermen in the north lost water, so much so that salmon died en masse, and the businessmen in the south got the water. Congress is now trying to override that act. Howard Leach says nothing that happened in that car, even though they had the conversation, there was nothing like a quid pro quo. He insists on that, and he says it was just good common sense that caused President Bush to move the water south. But that's what he says.
Let's look at big business interests. I think the biggest of the big is ADM, which I think our listeners might know is Supermarket to the World, because that's the way they advertise themselves on the commercials. Mm. It's a big agribusiness concern, also a producer of ethanol.
Right.
And in your Frontline special, you have some stuff on Dwayne Andreas, who is the CEO of ADM. And he was the largest donor of the year.
Which is interesting because he's been around for so long. You'd think if the campaign financing laws had worked and public money had replaced private money, then Dwayne Andreas would go away from the scene. You can go back to Hubert Humphrey's campaign for president in the late 60s. Dwayne Andreas gave him, or was indicted for giving him, an illegal sum of money. And then Richard Nixon received money from Dwayne Andreas. Some of the money that went to the Watergate burglars, $25,000, allegedly came from Dwayne Andreas. It was some money that he gave in a golf course. In our documentary, we discovered Dwayne Andreas in the Watergate files. We happened upon a document, that an interview with Rosemary Woods, in which she vividly describes Dwayne Andreas, same guy, arriving with a manila envelope containing $100,000 in $100 bills given personally to President Nixon and kept in the White House safe for a year. Well, this same fellow from 20 years ago doing it then is this year's, as you just said, number one contributor, not only to the Republican Party, but to the Republicans and the Democrats. He's back.
Well, he gave, I think, $1 million to the Republicans and $100,000 to the Democrats.
A little more than 137, I think.
What do you think he got in return for his donation to the Republicans?
This year, as you said, Dwayne Andreas makes a product from corn called ethanol. It's a subsidized fuel added to gasoline or substituted for gasoline, and it does require the constant attention and support of the U.S. government to market it against cheaper and arguably cleaner fuels. This year, President Bush, in the middle of the campaign, created a waiver that would allow ethanol to be marketed and essentially government subsidize it further, just exactly what Dwayne Andreas wanted. It will be worth a great deal to his company and to the corn farmers who supply him.
One of the things I found really interesting in your Frontline special is that Dwayne Andreas, the head of ADM, has a vacation condo in Florida. And in the same building are a lot of other very influential people whose names our listeners will recognize. You want to run through the list?
Yeah, this is really a mystery of sorts. There's a place on Collins Avenue in Miami, actually just north of the city line, in North Miami. It's not a particularly beautiful place or anything. It's sort of a plaster of Paris, stucco kind of verandas looking out over the sea against the sort of what's left of Miami Beach after the hurricane kind of place. In that place, however, in the penthouse, sits Dwayne Andreas, who's the head of Archer Daniels Midland. The program that Archer Daniels Midland sponsors, this week with David Brinkley happens to live there. And one of the correspondents who's the star of that program, Sam Donaldson, just happens to live there. And the Speaker of the House, former Speaker of the House of the Democratic Party, who had a wonderful retirement dinner given to him by Duane Andreas, which raised several million dollars, Tip O'Neill, he just happens to live there. And one of the big corn senators and a frequent candidate for president, Bob Dole, and his wife, Elizabeth Dole, a member of the Bush cabinet, just happened to live there. And Jack Stevens, who was one of the major contributors to the Clinton campaign and a major presence also in the Republican circles out of Arkansas, just happens to live there. It's just a weird tangle of influential people all under the same roof.
What do you make of it?
Well, they're all friends. And in a really interesting interview, another member of that household, as it were, Bob Strauss, currently the ambassador to the Soviet Union, who also lives there. I said, how come all of these people are under this same roof? He says, well, you know, we're all friends, and we may be combatants during the day, but when after dark in Washington, we all get together. And what a nice thing to do around Christmas time is to all come down to the place and, you know, be together. And we are the good people, suggesting that whoever wins this election, the good people who live under that roof, will all get together and do their deals and have their relationships, regardless of who's in the White House. There's a sort of a, as everybody knows, there's a crowd, and this is one of their hangouts, and there they all are. And they do deal with each other, you know, constantly.
Do you think that there's more than friendship beneath this?
Sure. I mean, this is the centrist faction of the political society. These are the people who talk about the nation in front of us, and the people who do a lot of the commerce, and the people who work in the legislature. I don't know that there's anything dark going on under the roof. It's just it's so cozy. That's the main thing. You're looking at the cozy center here.
Robert Krulwich is my guest. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is reporter Robert Krulwich, and he reports a Frontline special tonight called The Best Campaign Money Can Buy, and it's about political financing. Your Frontline show follows Bill Clinton as he got an early start with big money in the primaries. Do you think that that early start with big money was responsible for, or one of the things that was responsible for him becoming the front runner?
No question. Had Bill Clinton not raised the most money the fastest, he wouldn't be where he is today.
How did he do it?
Well, that's an interesting tale also. The documentary begins with a gathering on the at the estate of Pamela Harriman. We take you all the way back to a point where the prospect of the Democrats winning the White House was just as extremely distant, as distant as it could be. The president had just won the war. He was riding an all-time high wave of popularity. And Ron Brown and Pamela Harriman had a little party. They invited many of the people who had given $100,000 or more in the previous campaign to come to the meeting. So there were envelope stationery kings, there were Hollywood moguls, there were folks from Miami who run hospice centers. Some of them were youngish, there were some in their upper 40s, many of them in their lower 50s. Some of them beginning to go into retirement at that age, some people can do that. And they all met and drafted a statement of principles. They wanted to see a more business-like candidate, and they wanted to see a more centrist platform if they could get it. Ron Brown said to him, but what we really want to do is we want to create a group of people, and we want you to pay for them, by the way, you guys, who will be the early computer people, the early research people, the early outreach people, the early contributions people, the early issues people, a campaign in embryo sitting there and waiting. You'll pay for them. And now let's invite the candidates up to this estate and ask them, if they are nominated by the party, will they use them? Will they promise to use the structure we set up so that when the campaign begins, they'll have answers right away to charges, they'll have money right away to move, they'll have professionals right away to advance them, and so on. And so candidates came to this meeting and were screened by these businessmen and made their various promises. This group was not a group that picked the candidate, hardly. They didn't have that kind of power. But they could make their preference for a more centrist candidate known, and they got pledges of support and willingness to do it from several of the candidates, including Bill Clinton, who was there, among others.
What do you think Bill Clinton might have given in return for the financial support that he got?
Well, we described then the three places where he touched money early in the campaign. He had his friends, the Stevens family in Arkansas, who are, by the way, religiously Republican folks and big supporters of President Bush, nevertheless gave the Clinton campaign money because they do a lot of business with the Arkansas government. But they also gave Bill Clinton, during his dry period, a huge amount of credit. They gave him several million dollars of bank credit in a bank that the Stevens family is a major stockholder of. So that was good to start with. Second, he went to New York City and met a wonderful guy on Wall Street who had just, he's in his early 50s, Ken Brody, and he just retired from Goldman Sachs. And he spent a good part of the winter raising money for Bill Clinton. And there were an awful lot of people who were in their late 40s who liked him and gave him money. And the third stop, we point out, is in, of all places, South Florida, where Bill Clinton, in an act of some bravado, goes in to Little Havana. You can't find in the United States a group of people more inclined to vote for a Republican candidate for president than Cuban Americans in South Florida. And yet he boldly walked in where no Democrat had yet gone and made a key promise to that group that opened up the territory for him, both for money and for votes. He promised that he would support a very, very stiff bill to fence in Fidel Castro, a very, very tough trade embargo, which even President Bush, the free trader, would not endorse. Bill Clinton went in under Bush's nose and endorsed the bill and opened up some money there. So we identified those three groups as the groups that gave him the money, which is a real long way of answering your questions. What did Bill Clinton get? He got support. He got tactical surprise, throwing the Republicans off. But when they discovered that their Republican stronghold in South Florida was tilting to the Democrats, or at least leaking to the Democrats, and he got probably, due to his friendship circle, more money out of the New York Wall Street group than any candidate had gotten before. The Cubans wanted a strong Fidel line. The Wall Street money, I don't know. I don't know that you can put a quid pro quo, even a spiritual one, alongside that money. That seems more friendship-driven, and they were just impressed. And maybe it's a little generational. They liked a young guy, because these were the younger Wall Street people. And the Stevens money is Stevens money. It's Arkansas money, Arkansas oil money.
So you have the Bush people and the Clinton people getting a lot of money, soft money, through wealthy individuals, corporate money. Now, we've got an alternative. We have Ross Perot, who says he put his wallet on the table for us.
Yes.
And he's not only isn't he taking any kind of special interest money, but he's not even taking the $55 million that the government gives you.
No.
When you run, which both Clinton and Bush have taken. That's taxpayer money. What do you think of the Perot approach to campaign financing, which is you just write out a check to yourself?
Well, it's not available to too many of us, but for a while it looked like he was getting away with murder, because here he promised at the outset to pay for the campaign himself, and then he shows up at venues where it doesn't cost him a penny. He shows up at Larry King, Good Morning America, CBS This Morning, and so on. And he shows up at places where they set out the chairs, they set out the lights, they set out the drinks, they set out the candy, and he doesn't have to pay a nickel. And he rides to considerable fame and attention on no money. And until October, well late into the election, people assumed that he got in and gotten out with a pledge to spend, but didn't spend anything. However, the tightwad that he was is not the tightwad that he remained. He switched gears and is now spending money at a rate that has never been seen in the history of American politics. The media campaign that he is mounting is going up in volumes of millions of dollars per week. He spent, I think, $18 million in 2 weeks, in the first 2 weeks of October, and is close to doubling it again. And when you turn on television, he's on with half hours, he's on with hours, he's on with 60-minute ads and 60-second ads and 30-second ads to promote the 60-second ads to promote the half-hour ads. He's on at many of the breaks now in morning television. You watch Good Morning America, Ross Perot has balked the entire run to the election. You can see him every morning and sometimes in several breaks. Like, he's always on, which will be a really interesting test, I think, of the value of inundating the audience with television advertising, what it gets you.
Do you find it ironic that Ross Perot, who's running as a kind of populist, is one of the wealthiest people in history, probably? It's a little contradiction.
It is a contradiction, and as anyone who looks at it a little closely can notice, he may be running as some character out of a 1930s Hollywood movie, but in fact he has been one of the most active users of his money in previous elections. I think in 1974 he was the single biggest contributor to political campaigns of that year. He was a Duane Andreas of that year. He has tried to buy, or it appears that he's tried to buy favors for tax breaks and so on for himself, spending tremendous amounts of money on the Ways and Means Committee of the House of Representatives many years ago, and spending it again and again on the Texas delegation.
So although now he's threatening to throw out the alligator shoes, was it, from Congress, he has hired
some of those same shoes in earlier lives, in his earlier life, yes.
I wonder, to wrap up, would you find more disturbing the idea of political candidates getting a lot of special interest money or the idea of somebody who's so wealthy he could just buy it all himself?
I find the latter more disturbing, although at one point in the documentary, there is the question of, does knowing about it bleed the moral difficulties out of it? If you knew, as you can increasingly do given our laws, that George Bush received this amount from so-and-so and that amount from so-and-so and this amount from so-and-so, and then you later learn, as you would learn if you watched our program tonight, that certain apparent favors were given to big donors, doesn't that give you the information where you can say, I hate this, I've seen the information, I make the connection myself, and I vote against this guy? Or does the fact that you know that Ross Perot is rich and that he confesses it and that he says these things like he wants to buy the election, does that mean that, well, he's told you the honest truth, now you can like it or lump it, as opposed to the sneaking that went on before Watergate, where people snuck, literally put money in secret valises and tucked them into secret safes and opened them up in dark corners? I guess it's better that the lights are turned on, but I don't really know that there's any less influence being peddled. And frankly, I don't sense that people are turned off by Ross Perot's money or even terribly turned off by the amount of money that's being spent here. It just seems now to be organically part of the territory. Just money flows when power is being sought in this country. And that's sort of disturbing. But I don't feel any, I didn't feel any anger. A little bit of embarrassment on the Democratic side when they talked about how they raised money, but joy on the Republican side. Unalloyed joy. There's one scene in the documentary where some common cause demonstrators are standing on a corner and they're yelling what they believe are epithets at people entering a $9 million dinner for George Bush. Fat cats, they yell from the corner. And these people are walking in front of them and turning around and saying, well, I don't know, I could be fatter. Yeah, I'm a fat cat. Look at me. And then they just walk up the street and they can't even get enough of it. They turn around, go back to the camera and take even bigger bows for having achieved fat-catedness. Well, if that isn't an epithet, then we're on a whole other planet here. And that's sort of what the documentary describes.
Well, Robert Krulwich, it was great to talk to you.
Sure.
Thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
And Robert Krulwich is the reporter for a Frontline documentary tonight called The Best Campaign Money Can Buy. It's about campaign financing, and you can see it on public television tonight. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, a talk with painter Larry Rivers about abstraction and realism, and artists need to be selfish, and painting nudes. Rivers has been called a genius of the vulgar. He's written a new memoir about his circle of painters, poets, and musicians in post-war New York. Also, classical music critic Lord Schwartz reviews a new, faster recording of Mahler's Adagietto, one of his most famous pieces. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush says that he's counting on undecided voters to help him win next week's presidential election. During a series today of talk show-style meetings in Iowa and Kentucky, Mr. Bush pointed to the latest favorable economic news. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports from Paducah, Kentucky.
In Iowa and in Kentucky, two states where Mr. Bush needs to close a sizable gap to win a combined 15 electoral votes, the president said he was vindicated by the latest gross domestic product figures for the third quarter.
You know, I was very pleased today that the figures came out refuting the Clinton-Gore claim of how bad everything is. The figures came out for growth in the third quarter, and the economy of the United States led Europe, led Canada, led Japan, and we grew at 2.7%.
The third quarter numbers are unlikely to change the minds of a record number of Americans who say they believe the country is on the wrong track, at least not in 1 week's time. But the Bush campaign is hopeful that a more positive message and some good news on the economic front will nudge tentative Ross Perot supporters toward the president on Election Day. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Paducah.
Democratic presidential contender Bill Clinton has been on the campaign trail in the South today as he campaigned in states that have voted for the GOP presidential ticket in recent elections. Speaking in Florida, Clinton told a rally that if Democrats carry Florida, then it's over. Leading in the polls, Clinton also denounced all this name-calling, and he told supporters one more week. After 2 days of appearances in which he accused Republicans of plotting dirty tricks against his family, Independent presidential candidate Ross Perot stayed out of view today. So far, Middle Eastern peace talks underway in Washington have not been derailed by the new fighting in Lebanon. The State Department has called for maximum restraint in the region, and the Lebanese negotiator says Israel has overreacted by driving into Lebanon. Barry Schweid reports from the State Department.
With peace talks a year old and quiet progress being made on at least the Israeli-Syrian front, none of the parties wants to call it quits, and that includes Lebanon, which sees the negotiations as an opportunity to push Israeli troops out of a strip along the border. Getting that done may not be easy, however. Israeli negotiator Yuri Lubrani said the buffer has shielded Israel from cross-border raids for 7 years. The talks are nearing a break for the American presidential elections and what could be a new surge of activity afterward. So far, the most promising front is the Israeli-Syrian negotiations, where Israel is talking about a territorial compromise and Syria is sending out peace signals. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schweid at the State Department.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 8 points in very heavy trading. This is NPR News. In Washington, the Bush administration announced today plans to buy $100 million in U.S. corn to be used in donations to other nations. U.S. Agriculture Secretary Edward Madigan says this corn will be given to certain Baltic states and countries in the former Soviet Union. Some U.S. farmers say this move is not enough to help them deal with low prices brought on by a record corn crop. In South Africa, a senior official of the African National Congress has been shot and killed. In recent days, at least 40 people have been killed in attacks on supporters of the ANC and the Inkatha Freedom Parties. Virgil Keane of the BBC reports.
Reggie Hadebe was an immensely popular figure among ANC supporters in Natal, who saw him as an uncompromising militant who could be depended on to take the political fight to Inkatha. He was one of the prime movers behind plans to march on Chief Buthelezi's capital, Ulundi, to demand the right of free political activity in KwaZulu. Ironically, Reji Hadebe was returning from peace talks with Nkata when he was killed. Hadebe was bitterly opposed to any meeting between Nelson Mandela and Chief Buthelezi. The people who supported him will not look kindly on peace overtures to Nkata now, whom they will almost certainly blame for this killing. And Nkata supporters will be equally reluctant to extend the hand of peace to the ANC. Chief Buthelezi's organization has suffered high casualties at the hands of gunmen believed to be members of the ANC's military wing, leading Nkata to accuse its political opponent of carrying out a campaign of genocide.
Virgil Keane reporting from Johannesburg. In Germany, that nation's leading research facilities have forecast only a slight 1% economic growth rate next year. A new study finds the economic situation in Germany to be weak. The survey also expects inflation in Germany to climb to 5% this year. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The late poet Frank O'Hara once described his friend, the painter Larry Rivers, like this. Larry entered the scene like a demented telephone. Nobody knew whether to put it in the library, the kitchen, or the toilet, but it was electric. Rivers describes his life in a new memoir called What Did I Do? Larry Rivers is one of the most prominent figurative painters to emerge during the period of abstract expressionism. As Carrie Rickey put it, he wedded representation with abstraction, parodied art history, anticipated by a decade the concerns of both the pop and color field painters, and prophetically engaged in what postmodernists might call appropriation and deconstruction. Rivers says in his book that he doesn't have the faith in self that abstract painters need. I asked him what he means.
I'm not the kind of painter who thinks, well, I did it, therefore it's got to be good or it has meaning or things like that. And so if I put down an orange and a blue and put a line through it and then a big square shape and things like that, I felt as if they're something necessary in carrying that off that I didn't have. I didn't sort of believe in it that way. I didn't really know what art was about in a certain way, or I still don't. You know, I'm not trying to be cute, but I don't really know what exactly it is about. And I can only get at those things that interest me. And I think I must also have something in my nature that wants people, more no matter who, from what part of life and things like that, to get something from the work.
Mm-hmm.
Something.
Now, often when you paint a figure, there's a feature that's missing, you know, like
yeah.
There's one eye, but the other eye is kind of blank. It hasn't been painted at
right.
all.
Yes.
How did you start doing that?
Well, I think there was a certain spontaneity in my work. In other words, if no matter what I was doing, I wanted it to come off sort of quickly or without too much trouble. And, you know, as yet I hadn't arrived to the point where I wanted things to look labored and that I really did a lot of hard work, which would be a reflection of a certain kind of good character. So the first eye, you don't have to worry about where you're placing. I mean, you just put it down somewhere below a brow or something like that. But when you come to the second eye, you really have to make calculations about how wide they're apart. There's no way of putting in a second eye unless you're Picasso to make them realistic without sort of real close judgment and changes and things that would slow you down, would make your hand work, let's say, from the knuckles instead of an arm movement. And I think that I just left it out at first. For those reasons, I didn't think it was necessary, really, what it amounted to. And I think there are other parts of the body missing, too, but people notice it in the face because the face is so clearly an image that we know all the parts of.
Something else you've done throughout most of your career is write on paintings. Sometimes the letters are stenciled, sometimes handwritten.
Yeah.
Sometimes parts of letters are missing or blurred. How did you start using words on paintings?
Well, I think that, don't forget the Cubists had the word journal. I mean, they would have a newspaper in their painting. So in other words, I didn't do anything that was that, new. The only thing is, I think I was bolder about it and didn't hide it in a certain way. And then it also, in certain paintings, it's almost the point of the painting. I did these vocabulary lessons, which obviously are words and features. And I thought that I thought there was something sort of ironic, I suppose, in all that. And please forgive me for trying to be ironic, but that was one of the reasons. Also, my hand is a very artistic one in the sense that I make gestures with my paint and they're like loose flowing and things like that. Whereas a letter has sharp edges and it's very much more definite than the painting. So the combination of this very definite thing plus this loose, you know, arty kind of work with colors all over the place seemed to make me happy.
You married when you were pretty young.
Yes.
Your girlfriend got pregnant, and that's right. How you ended up getting married. She already had a son.
Right.
But you didn't want a family. In fact, you wrote, "My life was not going to be about living. It was going to be about art."
Right.
So you felt pretty trapped by having a family.
I guess so. I given my personality, I probably didn't even feel trapped. I nothing was going to stop me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've felt a little bit something. Don't forget, I never really gave them up, and eventually I really brought them up. I brought up these boys and lived with the woman's mother. I lived with my wife's mother. I didn't live with the wife. So it's complicated looking it over. I mean, I was not going to be stopped from what I wanted to do, but at the same time, I wasn't going to abandon the boys or, you know, the mother. And we lived together, and they were very helpful in many ways.
Do you think that you couldn't have become an artist without being somewhat selfish?
That's right. I think I modeled myself on my distorted notion of what Picasso was about. I thought that somewhere along the line I had heard that, without reading it somewhere, that Picasso, you know, walked away from every relationship and children and things like that, and all that life was about was art. And I felt that that model was something that it was of interest to me.
Looking back, do you think that you behaved badly toward your family?
Some people might. I don't think I behaved badly. I made up for it. In one way, I was sort of, you know, on my own, selfish, things like that, but at the same time, I provided for them. And so it's not very different than what most men are about. They go to offices 8-10 hours a day, and they come back and don't bother me. They're looking at television or a newspaper, they're drinking a beer or whatever it is, and then the child walks in, they give them a 2-minute kiss. Maybe once a year they go somewhere for 3 weeks or something. I don't think life is that different, you know, among for myself and other people.
Mm-hmm. Okay. My guess is
selfish. I would never deny that I'm selfish, but I can make a case for everybody being selfish.
Mm-hmm. My guess is the artist Larry Rivers. He has a new autobiography called What Did I Do? We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is the artist Larry Rivers. He has a new autobiography. Now, your mother-in-law, who you lived with for many years, you painted her naked a couple of times.
Yes.
And I'll just describe her physically briefly. She's you know, an older woman, kind of heavy, an almost what we describe as peasant-like body.
Okay.
Is it fair?
I never heard that expression about a body. Go ahead. But anyway, you mean the painting that's in the Whitney Museum? It's Birdie Twice?
Birdie Twice, yeah. Why did you want, you know, it seems like a real taboo, don't you think, to paint your mother-in-law naked?
Well, I told my mother-in-law, if you read the book, that part, I said to Birdie, she sort of said, "Why do you want to paint me?" You know, she had the simple notion that an artist wants to paint beautiful things. She looked at herself. She didn't think she was beautiful. So I said, Rembrandt painted older women. I forget her name. Anyway, she's got her 2 feet in a stream, and she has a kind of a gown raised up. And she's not a young woman. Now, you didn't see her breast, but there are others that Rembrandt did where you do see this older woman. I thought that I I had a very special opportunity. I was able to get someone that age close to me who actually I could really look at and see what was going on. So it had two levels. I painted it to make a painting and things like that, but I couldn't help be aware of what, you know, happens to the body. I was actually amazed that it looked that good. What I mean, I'm talking about on a sexual level. She didn't really seem to me to be unattractive.
What do you feel you got about her character from that painting? And did you find something painting her nude in her character that you hadn't noticed before?
Well, not really. She was a very giving person. She was very slow. She could hardly dial a phone. She couldn't drive a car. She was very inept. She was one of the worst cooks that ever lived. But she was actually a terrific person, like in her givingness. I mean, the children walked all over her. She was ready to do anything. She had no life, no personality, or no desire to express something for herself. It was amazing. So I don't know what I could have caught other than that in the painting. I just tried by putting down certain colors to get what she looked like, really. I don't know. It's just like we look at people and we make up really stories about what they are by our eyesight. It's the same thing in painting. You look at the painting and you have some idea about the character, but they're all personal readings of your own. I really don't know what I got.
Were you uncomfortable or was she uncomfortable when she was posing for you?
I certainly wasn't uncomfortable. I felt that she maybe the first few times, and she sort of, it was okay. It was a son-in-law, you know, she thought that anything she could do to help. Mm-hmm. I told her, you know, that maybe we'll sell that painting, something. So she actually thought she was posing for the good reason, a working-class woman who thought that, you know, we would make some money or something like that. And
did you?
Did I? I think when I sold those paintings, they weren't very expensive and things like that. I made something, sure. But I wish I had a lot of them today. I would have made more.
Now, you also did a naked painting of your son, Joe,
yeah,
when he was 14. And right, there's a part in your book where he talks about what it was like,
yes,
to be painted by you. And he wrote that, yeah, he wanted to be immortalized in your paintings, but he didn't really want to hang around and pose nude for it. He was 14 at the time.
Right.
In the painting, he's nude except for his socks. He
right
says his pubic hair was just coming in.
Right.
And then the portrait was shown at the Southampton Gallery in Long Island, New York, and half of the high school from that area had their parental permission to go to the gallery.
Right.
And he was very embarrassed.
And yeah, in order to walk into that gallery, they had to have a note from their parents that they could walk into that gallery. Go ahead.
And then finally the police removed the painting
right
of your son, and he
right
was relieved. And he says to this day he has a twinge of embarrassment when he sees it.
Yeah.
Did you realize he was going to feel that way, that, you know, at the age of 14
no,
it was going to be
no,
kind of embarrassing?
No, they were all, it was all very jolly, like I suppose a lot of families in which, you know, you don't, there's a central pot everybody's dipping into, and that's the sort of the ones that don't speak of the dark things. I think that he may have felt that way, but maybe I even thought about it, but I didn't think it was anything too anything too much to ask of a child, truthfully speaking. And I think he actually, you know, he did. He knew he was a painter, and that's what I do, and that he would be useful. If he was embarrassed, I'm sorry. You know, so what?
So how did you feel when the police took the nude portrait of your son away?
I wasn't surprised, actually. I thought, you know, it's the United States of America, and that's what they do. And I thought it was following a certain pattern. I actually got a boot out of it. Like, in other words, when do you start hearing of people? Only when they do something sort of like Maple. No one heard of Mapplethorpe until those things were shown, and everybody got into the act about how horrible and pornographic and, you know, base it was and things like that. So I probably thought I was following a certain, you know, path of the avant-garde. Like, you do a painting, there's a lot of clamor, take it down, and then it ends up in history books. When that was first painted, thousands of people protested. Now look, it's a masterpiece. I must have thought all that.
So you thought maybe it was a good career move?
Well, not exactly career move, but you mean that they took it down?
That they took it down, yeah.
Maybe. Yeah. I didn't think exactly that way, but It got a lot of attention because of it.
You were very close with the poet Frank O'Hara.
Right.
You were lovers for a while, even yes though you don't think of yourself as homosexual and have, you know,
right,
been married twice.
I was
twice
so straight I could be homosexual.
But you write that you started thinking of yourself for the first time as sexually attractive,
yeah,
when you started hanging out in homosexual circles.
Right.
How did that affect you?
Well, how did it affect me? Well, I just said it. To feel sexually attractive is rather pleasant. But I think that I didn't get that. I'm not saying that that's why I got interested in men, but that there was that difference. in my existence that women didn't talk about, you know, some guy with a great ass or, you know, a great basket, as the homosexual talk at that time, and the area around the fly as it's telling you what's going on inside it. But it was sort of interesting. I mean, it brought me up to another level about sex, that I too could be, exciting to someone, is really what it amounted to. Now, I really wanted it to be with women. They would go to bed with you, but I never got the feeling that they went to bed with you because you were sexually exciting. I don't know. I mean, it's kind of silly. I feel now like a baby. I can't see how they could have not thought that. Why would they go to bed with me? They wanted to have sex with me. But I never interpreted it that way.
When you were younger, you were part of a circle of artists, musicians, poets. And, I mean, there were even, like, artist bars to hang out in. Is there anything in your life like that now?
No. I have a band, but there's no place. You have personal friends. And I don't go to bars. It's embarrassing.
It's embarrassing because people know you, or?
No, not because people know me. It's that I thought bars were a place to go to try to pick up someone. Forgive me. And to the idea of sitting there with this notion in my mind, looking the way I do, and getting the treatment of Mr. Rivers, where you're no longer a possibility for a liaison, but just respected citizen of Southampton or wherever you are, or they don't even know. It's too obvious, and I think that it just doesn't work anymore.
Okay.
So I stay home and paint.
Larry Rivers' new book is called What Did I Do? The Unauthorized Autobiography. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. There's some good economic news just in time for the election. The nation's economy is growing a little bit. We're going to have a report from Mike Schuster about the growing movement of Russian nationalism, which is posing a considerable threat to Boris Yeltsin. Lynn Neary, who was out traveling last week having conversations with voters, asking them why they decided to vote the way they have decided to vote. This time she'll be talking to women, Democrats in Decatur, Illinois. And we have a stump speech, another minority party stump speech, this time from the candidate of the Natural Law Party.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Gilbert Kaplan is a publishing executive who loves Mahler. A few years ago, he learned how to conduct Mahler's Second Symphony, and his recording became quite a hit. Now he's learned the brief fourth movement of the Fifth Symphony, the Adagietto. It's just been released as a CD single. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review. Here's the opening of the movement.
Mahler's Adagietto, or Little Adagio, for strings and harp, is one of his most beautiful lyric movements. So beautiful, it's often played without the rest of the symphony. It's also one of Mahler's most famous pieces. You might remember it as the theme music in Visconti's movie version of Death in Venice. There's some controversy, however, about how it should be played. Mahler marked the opening sehr langsam, very slow. And some distinguished Mahler conductors, like Leonard Bernstein and Bernard Haitink, take Mahler quite literally. Haitink stretches out the adagietto to nearly 14 minutes. But Mahler himself apparently took only 8 minutes, which is also approximately how long Mahler's disciple Bruno Walter takes on his classic versions. According to Gilbert Kaplan, Mahler wrote the Adagietto as a love letter to Alma Schindler, the woman he was just about to marry. Kaplan says that performances should be romantic, not dirge-like. He brings his in at 7 minutes and 57 seconds. This tempo is convincing, and the London Symphony Orchestra sounds beautiful. But something about this performance strikes me as not right. It's almost too pretty. Under Bruno Walter or Pierre Boulez, who's even faster, the Adagietto seems to float. Yet they also phrase the music with inflections, the little pushes and pulls of complex human feelings. In the middle section, Mahler injects something darker into the movement, an element of real tension. But I don't hear this in Kaplan's rather sentimental reading. Once he's decided on the faster tempo, he seems to shift into automatic pilot. It's as if he thinks music can do only one thing when it has the unique capacity for bringing countless feelings together. The soft focus engineering also contributes to my sense of this as the Mantovani version. My bet is that this recording will become quite popular, and it's certainly not worthless. I think it's doing something valuable for our understanding of this music. But when I hear a great conductor take a similar approach, the music comes completely alive for me in a way it really doesn't here.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a new recording of Mahler's Adagietto, performed by the London Symphony Orchestra, with Gilbert Kaplan conducting. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet the former head of the National Endowment for the Arts. John Frohmayer was forced out because of his disagreements with the Bush administration over public funding of the arts. Also, we talk with writer Armistead Maupin, best known for his fiction series, Tales of the City. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.